This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. It's time once again to discuss this past week's important news with our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hi.
Another dramatic attack on oil tankers in the Middle East yesterday by Iran. This escalates tensions between the U.S. and Iran even higher, and they've already been quite high. And for this, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent.
Yeah, you've probably seen the footage of this. It's quite remarkable to see a tanker burning up, at least part of a tanker. And this took place in the Gulf of Oman, just outside the Strait of Hormuz, the exit point of the Persian Gulf. Again, this is the area where 20% of the world's oil, 30% of seaborne oil comes out of through this little choke point. And then you have the Gulf of Oman. And there were two separate attacks that took place on tankers. Some of them didn't have crew. They had other petrochemicals and other things, but they were full. One of them was a Japanese ship en route from Saudi Arabia to Singapore. The second one was a Norwegian-owned tanker bound for Taiwan from the United Arab Emirates. And so it looks like they were hit by the limpet mine. These are magnetic mines, similar to an attack that took place about a month earlier on the other side of the Gulf of Oman by the territory or by the nation of the UAE. This was about 20 miles off the coast of Iran on the northern part of the Gulf of Oman. And so, again, here we have tankers that are full of their fully loaded, en route this time, not to Europe or elsewhere. They're en route to Asia, and now they are burning up. And while they haven't sunk, these vessels are going to take a bit to repair them.
How do we know Iran's involved?
We don't know 100%, but I'd say 99.9% we do. One of the reasons is the United States has recently published some footage of Iranians on a fast boat that are by one of these ships, and it looks like, it's pretty grainy, but it looks like these people are trying to take off an unexploded or undetonated mine off the side of this ship. The Navy released this footage today. It took place yesterday at 4 p.m. And so you have... looks like, if you look at the boat that these men are on, it looks like the one of the boats that are in the Iranian IRGC, and they're trying to get rid of partial evidence. Iran has since came out saying that, well, they are in charge of safeguarding navigation through there, so it makes sense that they would be doing this. But it looks like it is Iran again. Who has this ability to do this in the Persian Gulf? Who has the motivation to do it? Who said that they wanted to jeopardize or at least put in danger oil transit and petrochemical transit from the Persian Gulf? Iran did. They said, if we can't allow our oil to go to market, we're not going to allow others to get their oil to market either. And so it definitely looks like it's Iran behind this.
How has the U.S. responded to this, and what does this mean for relations going forward?
Well, obviously, this is not what anybody wants. The United States doesn't want to see the oil price rise. It rose 4%. That's quite critical, 4% just after these attacks yesterday. And so they don't want this to happen. Obviously, there has been a ratcheting up of pressure and tension between the U.S. and Iran over the past month. There's more of the U.S. military hardware in the region right now. And there have been a series of Iranian attacks over the past month. The embassy in Baghdad had to be, non-essential staff had to leave that because of attack. And then you also had these attacks that took place on May 14th, I believe it was. And so what's also interesting is this attack took place exactly when the leader of Japan, Shinzo Abe, was meeting with the Ayatollah Khamenei. This was the first visit that Japan had to Iran since the Islamic Revolution. And he was carrying a message from Mr. Trump that Mr. Trump is willing to negotiate with the Iranian regime. And the Ayatollah put out a tweet directly after this saying that we thank you, Mr. Abe, for coming, but no, we will not be talking with having negotiations with the United States. And at the same time that that's happening, there is this explosion that takes place in the just outside the Persian Gulf.
So we talked recently when we were discussing the results of the inquiry into the last bombing of oil tankers a month ago, that what kind of message is Iran sending by continuing to ramp up the pressure and demonstrating its ability to disrupt oil shipping through this area? The fact that it continues to escalate, what do you make of that?
I think Iran is trying to show exactly that. I mean, what's also interesting is that those attacks last month, you didn't have any fireballs, you didn't have any ships on fire, there was an explosion, but they were placed in the precise location to ensure that the ship's cargo and that there wouldn't be this huge damage to the ship. And now we have two ships that have exploded. The cargo doesn't seem to be, you know, spilling or anything like that. But this looks like a more intense version of what happened previously. And it is just good to remember that Iran does have the ability to disrupt trade through here. They have so many ways. They won't be able to beat the United States in a war, but they have these fast attack boats. They have drones. They have mines. And it's important also that these attacks are not taking place inside the Persian Gulf, not even taking place on the Strait of Hormuz. Iran is demonstrating that they can act in the Gulf of Oman, in the Indian Ocean. And we shouldn't be surprised. Over the past 2 years, Iran has decided to increase the extent of its naval exercises outside the Persian Gulf, including the Gulf of Oman, including the Bab el-Mandab on the other side of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula off the coast of Yemen. Iran has been training for military naval activities in these very regions over the past couple of years. And so Iran is showing, with plausible deniability, that's the way they work. That's the way they've always worked through such proxies, so that you can't really, I mean, it's so unclear or it's not 100%, so you're not going to go and, you know, attack them with a heavy hand. At least the United States hasn't done that yet. And so this is the way that Iran acts, and they can do more. They can do far more than this. Already there's a couple of companies that decided they're not going to send their ships to the Persian Gulf until this has been resolved, this issue. You're going to see the increase of insurance premiums on such vessels that are coming out of the Persian Gulf. So while there still might be oil flowing out, the cost of oil is going to go up for the time being, and Iran would be happy with that. And I don't see this going away. I think we can expect to see Iranian actions like this in the Middle East from here on out.
It seems the United States has worked so hard to try to pressure Iran to put a fence around its activities, to deprive it of the cash that it needs in order to continue these terrorist-type activities. Iran seems very intent on demonstrating that it is unbowed by that pressure. What do you, just to put a cap on it, looking at this from a prophetic standpoint, what do you see going forward in terms of, or what does this say about Iran and the role that it's going to play in events in the future?
Yeah, the economic situation that Iran is in right now is so dire. It's worse than existed in 2012, 2013, which brought Iran to the negotiating table back then. It's far worse than that. And yet they're not budging. And I think this shows that they are not going to come towards a negotiation. These type of actions don't cost much for Iran. A couple of boats, a few mines, some naval divers don't cost much. And so they can have a huge impact on the world through such a small act as this. The Bible talks about Iran, and we've talked about Iran for over 30 years as being the biblical king of the south, which is a conglomeration of nations, really, that is backed by Islamic terrorism, or that uses Islamic terrorism to push the world towards war. That's what it says in the scriptures there in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40. And so we don't see Iran changing its behavior. It may be weakened in some facets some territories, be it Lebanon, Syria, because of the financial sanctions. But you're not going to change the motivation of the Iranian regime. They can't change where they've been going. The only reason they negotiated back in 2012 is because they saw the United States as an easy negotiator. They knew they would win that negotiation. They added so many things to the negotiating table that weren't there because they knew Mr. Obama was desperate for a deal. They're not going to win a negotiation with Mr. Trump, it seems, and so they're not even going to sit down at the table. And that is something that Bible prophecy indicates, is that they are not going to change their game plan, their vision for the future. They see themselves as somebody that's going to dominate the region. And if you want to read more about our longstanding forecast for Iran, you really do need to read our editor-in-chief's book, The King of the South.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Brent. Moving on, it is not quite official yet, but probably as close as you can come at this point to knowing who Britain's next prime minister will be. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, it looks very probable, though not quite certain, that Boris Johnson is going to be the next prime minister of the United Kingdom. The Conservative Party held the first round of votings for their leadership election yesterday. And, you know, the way those work, it's a bit like some kind of game show where they held these rounds of votings, and at each stage, the weakest performing candidates are eliminated. They have these stages until it's whittled down to just two candidates. In these elections, on these rounds of voting, it's just Conservative MPs sitting in Parliament that vote, around 300 or so. Once it's whittled down to the final two, then those two go head to head in a round of voting that includes all members of the Conservative Party. They're around 100,000 or so, 150,000. I forget the exact number of Conservative Party members, the kind of the more ordinary people that contribute to that party all over the country. So in that first round yesterday, Boris Johnson got so many votes that that level of support is enough to be in the final two. As long as nobody deserts him who voted for him yesterday, he is in the final two. Then you look at all the opinion polls, and they just about all say that he is overwhelmingly popular among Conservative Party members, that if he's in the final two, he will win. So it does look very probable that he could win. People have said the only person who can defeat Boris Johnson at this point is Boris Johnson. And he has said almost nothing, because basically it looks like he's got it in the bag, and the big thing he has to do is just not say anything that gets himself into trouble. So he's staying away from a leadership debate on Sunday, for example. It seems like he's just going to try and say nothing. And if the polls are correct, at least cruise on to victory.
So Stephen Fleury was talking this morning about just what a mess the next prime minister is going to inherit from Theresa May. What does Boris Johnson represent? He obviously has his detractors, but he has a lot of people who seem to have quite a bit of faith that he's going to be able to make some headway where Theresa May was not. What does this mean for Brexit? How does it change Britain's relationship with Europe? What are your thoughts?
So for Brexit, he said very firmly, we're leaving October 31st, come what may. You know, none of this, we'll do whatever we want, whatever we need to get a deal. He said, we're going out. Now, thanks to, in part, the mess that he has been left and the position that, not just Theresa May's fault, but just the divide in Britain's society and all of that background, it's not going to be quite that easy. So we'll have to see exactly how that plays out. Parliament, for example, a majority in Parliament may try to stop that from happening. There's even all kinds of discussions going on now on arcane parts of constitutional law, and can he shut down Parliament to stop them from stopping him, and all of this kind of thing. So we'll have to see how that goes. But definitely he has been talking much more about a hard Brexit, much more about we are getting out of this thing, much more about we're not just going to give Brussels whatever they ask for. So it does seem that it puts Britain on course for a clean break with Europe. And then at the same time, it does seem to put Britain on course for a much closer relationship to the United States. The President Donald Trump has had some, he's made clear that Boris Johnson is his preferred candidate. He has had some good things to say about him. And Mr. Johnson has talked more about working with the United States than some other of the candidates in the running have. So it seems like that's where we're heading. Clean break with Europe, closer relationship with the U.S.
Looking at this from a prophetic standpoint, both of those trends are things that we've talked quite a bit about. The closer relationships with the United States, I suppose there would be a lot of facets to that, that it would be, it could go in a number of different directions. But the way that prophecy talks about it, the United States and Britain, it lumps those two together in some really interesting ways. And the relationship between them has reflected that for quite some decades. It's been pretty rocky in recent years. But a closer relationship between those two give us an idea of what that could mean. And also the Brexit side, why that would be prophetically significant.
Yeah, this overall trend really ties in with some of those key prophecies. You know, Mr. Armstrong wrote for years that Britain was going to leave the European Union. And so at the Trumpet, we forecast that as well, that Britain was going to leave the European Union. Sure enough, you had that vote. And so now with Mr. Johnson's election, he puts us on target for that clear break. And then, you know, as you said, at the same time, you know, the Bible talks very clearly about curses coming up upon Britain and America. And you can look at some of the details, and the book of Hosea especially talks about those two powers falling together and going down at the same time. There are other more recent prophecies that we've talked about in terms of Britain following the same path as America under President Donald Trump. And so you can see all of that reflected in these news events. If you'd like to know more about these forecasts, one good place to start is we have our trends article, Why the Trumpet Watches the UK's Break from Europe. And that goes through that background and tells you, why we've been watching this, what the Bible says about Britain's relationship with Europe and with the United States. And then if you've read that, if you want to get into this in more detail, I'd really recommend you read The United States and Britain in Prophecy. That really is the blueprint that you need to understand, what the Bible says about world events right now. Britain's role, America's role, basically God's role in all of these events that we're seeing and that we talk about on this show. And of course, you can get all of those at our website, thetrumpet.com.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Richard. And we will keep our eye on how that unfolds in the coming months. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. Massive protests are taking place in Hong Kong over a controversial bill being imposed by China. To learn about this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the streets of Hong Kong are teeming with protesters. And in many ways, this story really begins in 1997. That was the year that Britain handed Hong Kong over to China after having flown the British flag there for 156 years. And during those years, Britain transformed Hong Kong from what was just a sparsely inhabited, basically just a few fishing villages, to this beacon of just unbelievable economic prosperity and modernity. So when Britain handed it over to Chinese control in 97, the people of Hong Kong, they were mostly of Chinese ancestry, but many of them had actually fled the mainland for Hong Kong as political refugees. So they were very wary of that handover. They were very concerned that Hong Kong would be sort of swallowed up by the mainland and by the Communist Party. So China decided to allow 50 years. They promised that for 50 years, Hong Kong would be allowed to retain its economic policies and a high degree of autonomy. And that autonomy included being able to continue their judicial system the way the British had set it up. So that means rule of law. That means innocent until proven guilty. That means you can't just be incarcerated or executed because somebody high up in the government decides that they don't like you or something that you said. China, in terms of its judicial system, if you can even call it that, is exactly the opposite. They secretly detain lawyers. They secretly arrest people who post things on the internet that are, critical of the government or critical of Xi Jinping, the president there. 3 months ago, one of my favorite Chinese musicians vanished. This is a very popular singer named Li Ji, and no one's seen him for actually 3.5 months now. So that would be like if, I don't know, Rivers Cuomo just suddenly vanished because his songs were too critical of the U.S. government. So anyway, in China, there's no freedom of speech. There's basically no human rights. And this question and the difference between the two judicial systems is why everybody in Hong Kong is out in the streets right now. The Hong Kong government is on the cusp of passing an extradition bill that would allow mainland China to transfer suspects to China to stand trial. So basically, this bill would mean that anyone in Hong Kong who sang a song that was critical of the Chinese government or wrote something in some online forum that was too critical of the Communist Party could be yanked up by the Chinese on false criminal warrants. And then who knows what? Maybe they'd be given a trial in kind of a kangaroo court, or maybe they would vanish temporarily or forever. And in Hong Kong, they're just terrified of this. It's only 22 years into this period that was supposed to be 50 years of autonomy, and 50 years when they were supposed to be allowed to run their judicial system for themselves. And now China is pushing for this law that would just decisively end that era before it's even half over. So some media outlets are saying that as many as 1 million Hong Kongers have come out to protest, even at a time, and there are only 7.3 million people in Hong Kong. So wow, that's just an astonishing percentage of the population there that have turned out to show just how terrified they are of China's tightening grip.
We were looking recently about China's response in Tiananmen Square 30 years ago. They don't tend to take very well to challenges to their authority. What do you think the outcome of these protests will be?
Well, I think that Hong Kong is a bit different from Tiananmen Square, sure, just because it's not in the heart of the mainland there.
Right.
So in this case, I think mainland China can just bide the time. Time is on their side because the protesters they're intense. They're very upset. But, you know, I've been in contact with a source in Hong Kong over the last couple of days. He's very much on the side of the protesters, and he says that as many protesters as there have been, there would be many, many more, except that it's difficult to take time off work, not only for financial reasons, but it's also politically risky, mm-hmm, to take a day off work suddenly when everybody's out in the streets, because it kind of leaves a paper trail showing that you were probably involved in the demonstration. So from the mainland's perspective, all they really have to do is tire the protesters out, just exhaust them, and I think it'll go exactly the way it did back in 2014 when we saw a big flare-up of protests there. They basically, the mainland didn't say much, didn't do much, but they exhausted the people and they ended.
But then the bill goes through, or China ends up having this ability to extradite Hong Kong citizens?
Right, yeah. It looks very unlikely to me that Hong Kong would be able to prevent this bill from passing.
So this is obviously something that a lot of people should be intensely interested in, considering just how much China is increasing its presence in really countries all over the world. It's been very active, as we've been talking about, throughout not only Asia, but also other continents. I guess it kind of gives you a sense of what happens when you let China in to some degree. Obviously, the way that it would respond to Hong Kong, which it considers part of China, would be different than the way that it would treat other nations. But it does expose the way that China operates.
Very much so. Yeah, from the Chinese leadership, we often hear that the world should embrace China's rise. You know, the nations of the world should invite China in with the Belt and Road Initiative and with those kinds of projects. China always insists everyone will get wealthier and we will allow these other countries to preserve their autonomy and their freedom. But these scenes out of Hong Kong this week reveal just how inaccurate that message is, because Hong Kong has let China in. It wasn't necessarily the choice of the people there, but back in 1997, they let them in, and now we see what's happening. My contact, who I mentioned a moment ago, he has to only be identified as Bill because he's terrified of the Chinese government, and he said he actually has friends who have spoken out against the Hong Kong or against the Chinese government, and now they're no longer able to enter the mainland. just from a few comments they've made. But anyway, I asked him this very question, and he said, quote, "From the bottom of my heart, I would warn anyone in any country, beware of the Chinese government. They are scary as an enemy. Any conspiracy you can think of, anything as cunning as you can imagine, they make it come true." Hmm. And then he mentioned some examples of authoritarian overreach that he's seen in Hong Kong. And I think that should be a wake-up call for the Sri Lankans, for the Filipinos, for so many other countries who have begun to invite China in to their borders. In the short term, it may appear that China's helping them build infrastructure, and that is helpful in some ways, but the Chinese Communist Party's priority has always been expanding its own power. And these countries that have invited China in, I think they'll find out the hard way that that was a mistake.
Looked at from a prophetic standpoint, where would you go to help readers understand the significance of what's happening here?
Yeah, there are actually several different facets of this that are prophetically significant, just China's rise and the times of the Gentiles and things like that. But really, one of the main reasons why China is increasingly interested in Hong Kong specifically is because of the island's strategic location right there at the confluence of the Pacific Ocean and the South China Sea. This location means that Hong Kong really functions as one of the sea gates that allows access to the South China Sea. And Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury highlighted the importance of this back in July 2016 in the Trumpet, just in the way that China's tightening hold on Hong Kong has really boosted its efforts to rule the South China Sea. And he explained that this development is, it takes on a lot of significance in terms of the Bible prophecies about sea gates. In Genesis 22:17, it talks about Great Britain and the U.S. coming to possess the world's sea gates that allow access to so many vital shipping lanes like the South China Sea. And then he also mentions Deuteronomy 28:52. Which forecasts that the British and Americans would later lose control of those sea gates and see them handed over to antagonistic nations. So Britain's handover of Hong Kong to China, it was terrible for the British and for the Hong Kongers. And it's clearer with each of Beijing's authoritarian pushes against Hong Kong, such as this new extradition bill, that it really was just kind of a move by China to grab one of those sea gates.
Well, we'll put a link to that Hong Kong handover in the show notes. We also have an article that Gerald Fleury has written, China is Steering the World Toward War, that gives a good overview of China's activities and why it's prophetically significant. Thanks so much for that, Jeremiah. Excellent stuff. We are working on the next print edition of The Trumpet, the cover story by Gerald Fleury about corruption from the Obama administration that's being uncovered right now with William Barr becoming Attorney General. It's a major, lengthy article, and you can look forward to that on the Trumpet site within a couple of weeks. The legacy of the Obama administration continues as so many of his staff have entered mass media, and they're continuing to have significant public influence. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Right. When Obama was president, two of the biggest scandals they were involved in were the NSA spying scandal, where you have government spy agencies, intelligence agencies, working with Silicon Valley, or at least cooperating with Silicon Valley, Google, even Apple in some cases, to collect data, unconstitutionally collect data on wide swaths of American citizens. And then you also had a number of media stories to where you had a member of the Justice Department illegally investigating journalists from Fox News. You had the one, I forget which news agency it was on the left, where they were actually running the articles by the CIA for fact-checking before publishing. And so Obama's deep state, this huge bureaucracy he ran, had very close relations with Silicon Valley and with CNN and MSNBC and the Washington Post and the New York Times and a lot of these liberal major media outlets. That's now coming in handy for them that as you mentioned before, with the Trump administration and Attorney General William Barr starting to flush some of these deep state agents out of the government. They need to do something else, and so they have many, many friends in Silicon Valley and in the media. There was a meeting President Obama called on January 5th, 2017, and the purpose of the meeting was to figure out how you can continue investigating Donald Trump after he's president of the United States.
Without him knowing about it.
Without him knowing about it. So, but he had all his chief intelligence officials there. You had and a few others, because you had in this room, you had Obama himself, his vice president, Joe Biden, Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates, FBI Director James Comey, National Intelligence Coordinator James Clapper, CIA Director John Brennan, and a couple other people working with this investigation into the allegations against Trump-Russia collusion. It's interesting when you actually see a couple years on, or like, where are these people now? I mean, we all know where Joe Biden is. He's the front runner for the Democratic Party nomination right now. Barack Obama is working for Netflix. He's got a number of documentaries lined up. I think the biggest one right now is going to be called The Fifth Risk: Undoing Democracy, which is an examination of Trump's failure to effectively staff three major government departments. So definitely using his media connections to produce documentaries about the Trump administration. But even that, the couple of those other people in the room, Sally Yates and James Comey, went back into academia. But John Brennan, the CIA director, now works for MSNBC as a television talk host. And James Clapper works for CNN. And then if you actually look at some of the other statistics, I mean, the number of Obama people who either work for Facebook or Google or these CNN or MSNBC, it's in the hundreds. Mm-hmm. It's in the hundreds. So, I mean, you've got all these deep state officials, including cabinet level CIA directors, national intelligence directors, that now work for media. And this is really relevant. We've got a book that we've sold. It's one of our more popular books. It's called America Under Attack by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, that's talking about just the significance of how the Obama administration changed America, specifically towards a direction of lawlessness. He has a statement in there that actually the devil has a three-pronged attack on this world. Number one, take out God's church. Number two, take down the nations of Israel, United States, and Britain. And then number three, raise up the Holy Roman Empire to attack those nations. And he talks about there's like an Antiochus figure that leads each of those three movements, that a hypocritical person who pretends they're more moderate than they are. And then even identifying Barack Obama as that Antiochus figure taking down the nations of Israel. So extremely prophetic figure. I think most people know this, the damage he did to the country while he was president, but now as the Trump administration starts sweeping people out of the deep state, I mean, they don't just go away. Mm-hmm. They go right back into their allies in the media in Silicon Valley. And so it's almost like a diaspora, the deep state. It might be more dilute in its center, but it's spreading.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating story. This is something that Andrew's looking into in quite some depth, working on a major feature story about this. We'll certainly be featuring that on thetrumpet.com, if not in the print edition. We may have to follow up on this in a longer segment on Trumpet Hour on one of our Wednesday programs. We appreciate you bringing that to us. And certainly do check out that booklet, America Under Attack. We'll put a link to that in the show notes for the program today. It's not a very long booklet, but it is power-packed, and it really gives an important perspective on these events within the United States. And it's still very relevant. It's talking about what was happening under the Obama administration while it was in power, but we're seeing those ripple effects continue to this day. So thanks for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We're going to take a short break. Coming up, evidence of Russia building up its military presence in Crimea, and Mexico admitting that 80% of its populated territory is being run by drug cartels. These stories and more right after this short break.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
We spoke in the first half about Iran attacking two oil tankers. Well, this isn't the only Iranian-inspired attack this week, showing just how active the Islamic Republic has been recently. To learn more, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this attack took place this week as well. This was on Wednesday. A cruise missile was fired from Yemen, from northern Yemen. This is an area controlled by the Houthis, which are an Iranian-backed group there that have been fighting a war against the Emiratis and the Saudis for about, I would say, about 4 years now. And they fired a cruise missile, and it hit an airport, an international airport in Saudi Arabia. 26 people were injured. What's really interesting about this, they've got footage of it as well. And this could have been a whole lot worse. It basically hit a spot at the airport where like one or two people were walking, rather than at a gate or something like that where there were people waiting to get on a plane, because we would have had a serious amount of deaths taking place from this. And this is not an event that takes place in a vacuum, or let's just say an event that is unique. We've seen such attacks like this over the past month pick up from the Houthis attacking Saudi Arabia in a remarkable way. If you go back to May 16th, you had 5 or 6 drones that flew into Saudi Arabia about 500 or 600 kilometers and attacked that pipeway, the critical east-west pipeway, oil pipeline that ensures that Saudi Arabia can pump oil out into the will ship oil into the Red Sea. That was attacked, and oil flow through that was shut down for a number of days. You've also had assassinations been taking place through drones flying into Saudi territory by the Houthis. And so this isn't a fight that is being contained to Yemen at all. Iran is using its proxy to hit Saudi Arabia from the south, and it just doesn't get reported on that much. But this is an international airport that was hit by a cruise missile this week, and I doubt anybody in the West actually heard about it.
How strong is the connection between Iran and the Houthis? How much can we look at Iran as being the real agent at play here? And how much do we put this together with those other incidents, including the one that we spoke about in the first half, in terms of recognizing a pattern on what Iran is up to?
Right. So the Houthis, they admit themselves that they get their funding and support from Iran. They have just sent a first installment of cash over to Hezbollah, another Iranian proxy of over $150,000. They're raising money for Hezbollah now, which shows a connection, because Hezbollah is running out of funds. You've had IRGC, Quds Force agents embedded and killed in Yemen with the Houthis before. And so while there is probably some degree of separation, you even can see the weaponry that they use. These are Iranian, very similar to the Iranian drones, Iranian-style drones. And even the targets that they choose, especially if you go back to last month, you had 4 tankers being hit off the coast of the United Arab Emirates, as we covered in the first half. And then 2 days later, you had the main oil infrastructure that ensures that Saudi Arabia can bypass the Persian Gulf and put oil into the Red Sea and get around the Bab el-Mandab and these choke points. That was attacked the same time, to basically show that there is one player behind here. Iran is able to shut down world oil trade, and they're going to use the Houthis to do that. We've been talking about this ever since the Houthis rebellion back in 2015, when they took over the capital. Our editor-in-chief was very much aware that this wasn't just another Arab Spring nation that was falling. This was a location that looks like Iran would control, based on the Bible prophecies found in Daniel chapter 11 that talk about Iran controlling the Red Sea passageway in the southern Mediterranean. Yemen sits on the eastern border of the Bab el-Mandab, and this is a 22-mile stretch that a lot, I think it's like 6 million barrels per day of oil passes through, most of that oil going up into Europe. And we've had proof over the past 3 years of naval mines being laid out here across this strait. We've also had exploding boats running into Saudi ships. We've also had land-to-sea missiles being used to cut target shipping, all from the Houthis. And so Iran isn't interested in the liberty of the Houthi rebellion and their takeover of the country because they love the Houthis and they want to give them a country. They're interested because it is such a strategic location to control because of the position that you get placed in and looking over the Red Sea transit. And so, yeah.
Well, excellent job of explaining why Iran would be so interested in Yemen. We're about out of time for this segment, but quickly, why would the Houthis, given the direction from Iran, be attacking the Saudis?
Well, the Saudis are there. The Saudis are the main fighting force against the Houthis right now in Yemen. They are leading the international coalition. So if Iran is to continue to have its foothold in Yemen, the Saudis are their main adversary there.
So this conflict between Iran and Saudi Arabia, is this essentially what we've talked about so often, this divide between these two main camps within the Middle East?
Exactly. And if people want to read more about this, they can go ahead and read the article that was written back in 2015 by our editor-in-chief. It's entitled "Iran Gets a Stranglehold on the Middle East."
Okay, thank you very much, Brent. U.S. intelligence officials are watching the Crimean Peninsula, which Russia took over 5 years ago, and they're warning about what Russia is up to now. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, The U.S. and much of the world is closely watching the Crimean Peninsula, and this week there was some newly published satellite imagery that shows that over the last 18 months or so, Russia has added 5 S-400 batteries, 5 S-300 systems, and many additional fighter jets, warships, troops, and weapons to locations all throughout the Crimean Peninsula. So this imagery was taken between January 2018 and April of this year by Planet Labs. They're a private company. And what these various images show adds up to just a really substantial buildup of Russian forces in Crimea. And it gives Russia better control over the Black Sea, and it puts its offensive vessels and aircraft nearer to the Mediterranean and the Middle East. It was just in March that we spoke on the show about some squadrons of nuclear-capable bombers that Russia had deployed to the Crimean Peninsula. And now we see that that was just the start, and that this is it's just a really formidable amount of military might that the Russians are setting up in one of their westernmost regions.
This has to be very concerning to Ukraine and other European nations.
Right, yeah. I think really the significance of Russia's increasing military might there is mainly in the effect that it will have on Europe. And that's because Europe they're terrified by what they saw with that annexation of Crimea in 2014, and by just how aggressive Russia is becoming there and elsewhere in the European periphery. I've got a quote here from this week. This is from the director of the Eurasia Nonproliferation Program at Middlebury College. And it's just about how this new satellite imagery might affect NATO, which is made up mostly of European countries. It says, quote, "This is a significant buildup. NATO is going to be under increasing pressure from allies in the region to show that it's able to push back against Russian attempts to gain greater control of the Black Sea. That's a really dangerous environment." End quote. Yeah. So, you know, NATO and Europe they're concerned. And as that statement said, Europe is now under pressure to show that it's able to push back against Russia.
And somehow Russia always seems to manage to do this in incremental ways that prevent just a very strong kind of pushback from its adversaries.
That's true. Yeah, there's the kind of salami slicing. This buildup is somewhat similar to that in that it's gradual. Although at this point, even if they did it suddenly and overtly, I don't know if the Europeans would be in much of a position to stop them, since, you know, their control over Crimea is not really in dispute at this point. But Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has said that Europe will increase its militarization in response to what it's seeing happen with specifically with Crimea, but also just in general with all of Russia's aggression. Back in 2014, right after Russia took Crimea, Mr. Fleury wrote an article called "The Crimean Crisis is Reshaping Europe." And he discussed prophecies recorded in the books of Daniel and Revelation, showing that a European power of 10 leaders would rise up in the end time. And he wrote, quote, "The fear you see in Europe because of events in Crimea is going to cause 10 leaders in Europe to unite in a sudden and dramatic way and in precise accordance with the Bible's description of this European empire." And in the 5 years since he wrote that article, Russia has just become even more aggressive, and now this week we see just how dramatically Russia is increasing its military might in Crimea. So I think it's easy to see just how the Europeans are becoming more fearful and how that fear will convince them to kind of lay aside their differences with each other and to form that biblically prophesied bloc of nations.
Very important prophecy to keep our eyes on. We'll put a link to that article, "The Crimean Crisis is Reshaping Europe," on the show notes for today's program. We'll also put a link to the prophesied Prince of Russia that exposes these prophecies revealing Vladimir Putin's role in end time events. Quite something to see this unfolding there, and you can be sure that Europe is paying close attention to it and will respond when they have the opportunity. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Our last Trumpet print edition has a cover story by our editor-in-chief about how Europe is working to control the internet. In anticipation of a G20 summit this weekend, EU officials are pushing to cement their dominance over how companies transmit data, doing what they seem to do best, using strict new regulations. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, we're seeing a big push in a few different directions from Europe to gain control over data around the world. You know, we've talked before in the Trumpet, in that article that you just mentioned, about how Europe is really instituting in its own country or in its own area really strict rules on the internet and data. What we've seen over the last week or so is Europe pushing to extend those rules all around the world. So you've got the G20 summit coming up on June 28th. And ahead of that, last weekend on Sunday, G20 trade and digital economy ministers, they all met together to talk about exactly this, as kind of part of the agenda of the upcoming summit, of harmonizing data protection rules all around the world. At the same time that they're doing this, last month, the Europeans, they went to the World Trade Organization and they talked to them about trying to, and they're pushing through the World Trade Organization to try and set global rules about sharing data all around the world. They put forward some e-commerce rules through the WTO in May that would basically establish things like privacy as a fundamental right, as well as free flow of data. And again, those things, you know, privacy as a fundamental right sounds great, but you're looking at the EU pushing privacy as defined in European regulations that we've instituted within Europe. And they're wanting these to spread all around the world. So they're working with Japan. Politico had a great article last week talking about how Europe is working as they negotiate trade deals with different nations, with different trade blocs. As part of those trade deals, they are putting in these data and internet regulation rules and saying, okay, well, if you want a preferential trade deal with us, you need to sign up to these deals regulating your internet. And so as they do that, they're bringing in more and more different parts of the world. And then, of course, you know, once you've got 50, 60% of the world on board, even countries like the United States say that don't sign up, there's just a huge amount of pressure on them to conform to these rules anyway, because most of the rest of the world does, and they have to do it to keep going with these countries. I'll just read you some quotes from this Politico article, because they do tie in so well to what Mr. Flurry wrote about in that Trumpet print edition. They wrote here, Brussels is pulling its weight as the world's top trade bloc to export its privacy rules. Europe may not have an Apple or a Facebook, but it does have one killer export when it comes to technology regulation. The EU already sets global rules for digital privacy, forcing countries from Argentina to Japan to rejig their national standards in line with the region's tough stance on data protection. Now the European Union wants to do the same with trade rules on data. So it's really regulatory imperialism from the EU pushing their data standards all around the world.
Regulatory imperialism. That's a good good term for it. Stephen Flurry brought this out in the Trumpet Daily Radio Show this morning. I think it was a quote that was talking about Germany, and he was describing how this is almost intrinsic to the German character that they want to control things. He was talking about just how much this is why Britain wants out of the European Union, because they don't want some bureaucrat in Europe telling them how long the wicks of their candles need to be, that type of thing. But it just seems like Europe is practically unable to help itself, that this is a major way that they're trying to control the world. That you see, Gerald Flurry was talking about this in his cover story, the way that they're regulating the internet through similar types of means. Tell us the prophetic significance of it just to wrap things up.
So one of the big things Mr. Flurry focuses on in that article is the way Europe's been passing these different laws that regulate what you can say online. In that article, he draws the attention to the way that Germany is behind a lot of this. But they're pushing the most recently, it's under the guise of a copyright directive. They've been basically forcing internet companies to put up filters so that at some point in the future, if they wanted, the technology would be there, the system would be there for the EU to filter out just about anything that they want. So one of the things that he drew attention to in that article is this really exposes the character of Europe. It exposes that you've got the Holy Roman Empire rising up in Europe. It exposes the fact that you've got, you know, an organization that wants to impose its will on its citizens, that wants to control what people say. And so as you see them trying to export this around the world, it exposes that power some more. It exposes this power as one that wants to control the way people talk, the way people post online, the way information travels all around the world. And of course, the Bible has a lot to say about this power that's rising in Europe. Revelation 17 describes it in detail. And this whole aspect of the EU just trying to clamp down on speech and the internet and data is a way that it exposes that power rising, the way the Bible talks about it.
All right. Well, we'll put a link to that cover story by Gerald Flurry on our last Trumpet edition, Germany's Controlling the Internet. In our show notes for the program today, we thank you for bringing that to us, Richard. The Mexican government has admitted that this country, Mexico, is virtually controlled by drug cartels. For this, our final story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, new data prepared for Mexico's president showing that 80% of Mexico's populated territory is run by cartels. A shocking statistic. I mean, in the past, Mexican government officials admitted that like probably 40% of their country, territory-wise, is run by cartels. But that data didn't take into the account that much of Mexico is sparsely populated mountains or deserts. And so new, more granular data looking at where people actually are means that of its populated centers, about 80% of that country has become what could easily be termed a failed state due to the drug trade and that violence. We did a cover story on it last year, and it's gotten quite a bit worse since then. 33,000 people killed last year. I think the average lifespan of a man in Mexico has actually gone down 6 months for the entire country, which you have to kill a lot of people before the average lifespan of a country starts decreasing. But and that is something we have, our editor-in-chief has a pretty extensive section in the No Freedom Without Law booklet on drug addiction and how it robs freedom from an individual's life. And this is basically that same lawless trend on a macro scale. In Mexico's case, they're doing more of the supplying, where it's mostly Americans who have the addictions. But between the two, I mean, yes, it takes freedom for individual lives, but it's like an entire country where 80% of its people are living in areas where drug trafficking agents arguably have more power than the government itself.
Well, we'll put a link to that booklet by Gerald Fleury, No Freedom Without Law, in the show notes for the program today. You can visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to all the articles and the literature that we discussed today. Thanks for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Thomas Jefferson. I'm a great believer in luck, and I find the harder I work, the more I have of it. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.